Hi, this is Marion Nessel. I'm the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and a longtime fan of Heritage Radio.
Like Marion, you too can support Heritage Radio Network, a member-based nonprofit radio station operating out of Bushwick, Brooklyn.
I've been on it countless times. I love being interviewed. The interviewers are always really well prepared and fun to talk to about the issues that matter to me the most, about how we can change our food system to one that's healthier for people and the environment. It's just invaluable to have an independent radio station that's dealing with these issues. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful asset.
Support Heritage Radio Network by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Chef Story. I'm your guest host, Eric Murnigan, president of the International Culinary Center. Today we're broadcasting from ICC in Soho, New York City. My guest today is Douglas Keene, a James Beard Award-winning chef, winner of Top Chef Masters Season 5, chef owner of Healdsburg Bar and Grill, and partner in the just-opened Two Birds, One Stone, located in the Freemark Abbey Winery in St. Helena. Douglas was also the chef owner of the award-winning Michelin two-star Cyrus in Sonoma County. Welcome, Douglas.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time to talk to me today.
Always good to be in Manhattan.
Good. I'd like to learn about your current and future projects, but first I'd like to learn a little bit more about your background and what led you to your career as a chef. How does a kid from Dearborn, Michigan become a celebrated Sonoma County, California chef?
The basis of it is parents that had a great work ethic instilled it in me, and then I was given a palate. At a young age, I had a gift of a palate. I could taste things. So take that back, and I loved working on, like, digging ditches and mowing grass and doing things that had immediate gratification. And so, and then I watched my mom cook, and she was a great cook, and then I had a really great mentor, a guy by the name of Stan Bromley, who was in the hotel business, and he was on the food and beverage side, and so I kind of idolized him. So all those kind of together, it led me to the food direction. I was drawn to food, I guess. And then in high school, I had a Catholic school, and I cooked with Sister Josephina in Foods 1 and 2 at Dearborn Divine Child, and it kind of, I did it just to get a date to begin with, like to get a prom date, which worked, but I loved it. I loved cooking the brownies on Fridays for the missions and stuff like that, so it felt natural.
All right. I'm intrigued by the prom date. Now, was this to you wanted to learn how to cook her a meal to be able to woo her into becoming a date?
No, I just knew there was a lot of cute girls in the cooking class.
So I decided
to get in there. Yeah.
And it worked.
It did work. Yeah.
Were you guys cooking anything interesting in that class, or was this kind of home ec stuff?
It was like an advanced home ec is what it was. I was surprised they had it, but they had a whole setup. There was like six different stations, but it was more like baking and meal planning and shopping type of stuff. But we cooked. It was neat.
So no doubt that you're successful, because I think people in this industry who are very successful are motivated to achieve a goal. And so I guess your initial goal was not cooking, but you figured out a way as a young man to do something that other guys hadn't thought about, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I was creative that way.
That's pretty fantastic. All right, so you graduated from high school.
Yep.
And you went to Cornell?
I did, yeah. I took my mentor, I told him I wanted to cook. And he said, well, I think you should try hotel school. And so I got accepted at Cornell, and I went there. And I almost left 2 years into it to go to cooking school. They don't cook as much anymore now up there. They do have a cooking lab, but it's kind of become more of a business school. But I cooked a lot there. I took extra credits and independent studies, and then I was always in the kitchen. So about 2 years into it, I said, I think I'm going to leave and go to culinary school. And the chefs up there said, don't leave. You can go to culinary school after if you want. Just stay here, finish your degree. It'll be the best thing you ever did. And so I did, and it was a smart thing. And then when I graduated, I said, listen, I think I'm going to go to culinary school. They said, well, why don't you – you've cooked quite a bit. Why don't you just go down to New York City and get the bejesus beat out of you? And I said, okay.
Okay.
So I moved down here, and I just came down and got pushed and to the limit. You know, I had no idea what I was doing. I had no business getting hired in any restaurant, but I did.
So were you cooking in restaurants in Ithaca when you were in school?
Yeah, I cooked I did a lot of pastry work at the Statler Hotel. I cooked at a bar called Johnny's Bar and Grill. It was my first cooking job, just greasy burgers and steamed mussels and french fries. And
perfect for a college kid,
yeah,
right?
Chicken wings, exactly. It was a fun place. Yeah, so I cooked all over there, yeah. And then every summer I would go cook at a different externship. Went out to San Francisco for a summer, stayed in Detroit for a summer. Went to Washington, D.C. for a little bit, too.
Okay. I'm always intrigued, and I think this. I think you did this. I'm intrigued by people who think about somewhere that they want to eat, and they eat there, and then they decide that, okay, this is the place I need to work.
Yeah, it was. So I was working at the Four Seasons in Manhattan, the one that's going to close in a couple months, or probably in a month, actually. And I would eat all around New York. I just saved my money and ate, ate every Sunday that I could get off. And I remember reading the review by Ruth Reichel about L'Espinasse.
Uh-huh.
And it just blew my mind the way she wrote about it. And I said, I have to go eat here. And so I saved up and went to dinner there, and I think it was the black bass or tamarind sauce or the kefir lime sauce. I can't remember which exact dish, but I literally ate it, and I stopped. I said, I should either work for this guy or I should quit cooking because I want to learn how this guy does this. It was just my mouth danced like it had never danced before. So I said, I'm going to work for this guy. So I kind of hounded him a little bit.
Did you make a connection that night?
He came out to the table. I was eating with another chef at the time. So he came out to the table and said hi. I think I stood up and clapped for him. It was probably embarrassing for everyone. I was just in awe of them. I really didn't know him as a celebrity at all. How good and how technical the food was just blew my mind. And the acid, the balance of acid and salt and sweet and texture. I just knew it was something that I wanted to learn. It was a very motivating meal. So yeah, I kind of made a connection, but no. I staged later. I got a stage there, and then there's no jobs to be had. I finally got lucky. It was interesting, but I was back, and I'd moved back to Detroit for a year to take care of my father while I was passing away. And after he passed away, my mentor, I said, I wasn't done with New York City. I wanted to work at a 4-star restaurant at the best. I said, I really want to work at L'Espinasse. And Stan is all uber connected. Somehow he got my resume to the GM who got it to Chef Coons. And
okay.
Next thing I know, I get this message on my phone at home and saying, we'd like to interview you. We'd like to, you know, but you're in Detroit. And I was like, I'll be there tomorrow.
Right.
So I packed up, went out, and he hired me.
That's great. So tell me about Stanley. How did you two connect?
So 1976, my uncle was in charge of Ford Motor Company's land development. Ford Motor Company was pretty big in Dearborn. And so he did everything that they owned land-wise. He would build for them. And he was building a Hyatt Regency, which was pretty big for the town at the time because there was really very little hotels there. And he had hired this guy, Stan Brownway, to be the first GM. His temporary offices were in the same office that my uncle and my father had their offices in. My dad was an attorney. And my mom actually had her business there, too. So Stan and my dad and my mom and his wife, Judy, became best friends. And so I bonded with Stan at a very young age. I was 5 at the time.
Okay.
He and I connected somehow.
So he was almost like an uncle, and he happened to be in the business, and that's kind of where it went.
Exactly, yeah. And he was a legend in the business. If you ask anyone about him in the hotel business, he's considered one of the best ever. And he never wanted to move past where he was because he always wanted to be connected to a property because he was good at making sure the coffee was hot and the butter was soft. And, you know, he likes taking care of people. He's good at it. Detail freak.
I also grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in Champaign, Illinois.
Yeah, right on.
So I think we can agree that that the produce and, you know, things there, you know, your fresh summer tomatoes were pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But there wasn't a whole lot of creativity or even exposure to interesting produce My mom was also a really good cook, and
yeah.
I wound up in this industry. So I guess there's maybe there's something to how good those tomatoes really are, and they stick
agree.
With us, huh?
Yeah, and it's also that short season, I think, of the growing season there, and you're so appreciative. But I remember tomatoes, peaches, blueberries, and beans, like fresh green beans. I remember those always being great. But yeah, other than that, it's slim pickings, you know. But I also remember I was a sophomore or a junior in Cornell, and I hated fish because every piece of fish I'd ever had was in Detroit. It was either lake fish or stuff that had been flown in and, you know, wasn't treated right. And I came down to Manhattan for a class. It was one of my restaurant classes. It must have been senior year. And we ate at Lutece, and Andre Soltner was still cooking there. And he cooked a black sea bass dish with like a bear blanc that just absolutely blew my mind. And I was like, oh my God, this is how fish is supposed to taste. And then I went that day to the Four Seasons and we had dinner there and they did a monkfish. And I was like, oh my God, I'm hooked. And for ever since then, I've been just addicted to cooking fish and seafood. It's my favorite thing to cook, I think, because of that.
Yeah, when it's done right, it's really good.
It's magical, yeah.
My favorite quote of Andre's, he's a dean here, as you probably know.
Yeah.
I'm paraphrasing, but it was something along the lines of, it took me 1,000 attempts to roast a chicken properly. So, you know, cook 1,000 chickens and you finally get it right.
Absolutely.
So
repetition.
I think there's something to that with the fish too.
Yeah,
right?
I agree. And fish is so technical. Like if you go just a little bit over or a little bit under, it's just not right. Each piece of fish, you kind of have to be right on top of, I think. Meat, you get to rest and cheat a little bit. You know, you can feel it. It's better if it rests, but fish, you kind of nail it.
Okay, so then you worked with Gray Koons. How long did you work with
Worked with Chef Koons for about a year. Yeah, it was a year. And it was brutal. I mean, it was a hard kitchen. And I was also going through a time where I just lost my father, and I was very close with him. And I moved back to New York just immediately. And so, it was a rough year. Many times I felt about leaving. But it was an inspiring kitchen because everyone in that kitchen was so good. Everyone was a chef already. They'd already run restaurants, most of them, or been very high up, and everyone came back to learn from this guy. Mm-hmm. And just you walk in and the cleanliness and the order and the perfection. I remember the first time I staged there, I came over with my tongs in my back pocket, and I walked in, and Stuart Woodman was working there, and he's like, dude, get those out of your pocket. I had no idea what he was talking about.
I know Stuart. I used to work for Stuart.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
At Zoe here in the city on Prince Street. Stuart was there for a short time.
And now he's in, Minneapolis,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. But it was funny. I was like, oh, I think I threw him in the trash. I'm like, I gotta get rid of these things, man. But I didn't know I didn't get it. That was how far, how more refined this was than where I was. And then just everything was wrapped perfectly. Everything was cut perfectly. And it wasn't that I hadn't seen really good food. I just hadn't seen it performed at that level. And it was just like, this is so much fun to try to strive for that. And so I put in as much time as I could that I could take. At that point, I was kind of missing family, too. So at the end of the year, it was like I was so sick of snow. I was just like, okay, I'm out of here. My brother and I had made a pact to move back to California, or to actually move to California together. So that's when I decided, all right, I'm out of here. But it was my finishing school at Les Bonnes.
And that's when you hooked up with Tracy Desjardins?
Yeah, I moved out to the West Coast, and I staged around a little bit. I worked actually on Jacques Pepin's cooking show for a little while, and at the same time I was kind of trying to find the right kitchen, so I had staged a few places, and I honestly was unimpressed. I had some sort of ego problem too, coming from like the best restaurant in New York to going to San Francisco, and at that time I'll probably get in trouble for this, but the food in San Francisco was good. You could go out and get really good meals, but it was very similar. Everyone was doing like crispy chicken with fingerling potatoes and braised greens, and but no one was pushing the envelope, in my opinion. It was kind of all from the Alice Waters ethos, and it was like everyone was afraid to kind of branch out. Like they had this amazing produce, but you shouldn't do anything but salt the right. tomato, you know? And so
simple.
Yeah,
just
simple,
right,
perfect.
But simple, but not a whole lot of creativity.
Exactly. No one pushing the envelope. No one manipulating things. And that might. I guess that's part of the California way. But coming from this kitchen in New York at Les Bonnes, it was at such a high level of just creativity and execution. To that, I had a hard time in San Francisco at first, like finding the right place, and above all, the cleanliness at L'Espanasse was so amazing. Every kitchen I walked into, I was disgusted with in San Francisco. Until I got into Tracy's kitchen at Jardiniere. And I knew a friend of mine, Rebecca Chapa, was the sommelier there. We'd gone to Cornell together. And so she got me the stage. And I showed up with a suit, and I think Tracy was like, are you kidding me? Who is this guy? That's just not her style at all. You know, I think she was kind of like wrote me off right off the bat. But I went in, I worked, put my head down, just worked for the day, and I watched, and people were sweeping the floor. Things were cooked, element new. The sauces had acid to them, and I'm like, and they were doing a decent amount of volume, you know, more than we did. Or, no, I'm probably about the same we did at L'Espanasse, but it was different because there was a theater rush. But I remember saying, I'd like to work here, you know? And so, and I was a relatively good line cook. Like, I liked repeating things. And so, I think I impressed Tracy that night. So she offered me a job. There wasn't a job to be had, but then all of a sudden there was a job to be had,
yep.
You know, after. Yep. And I'm like, yeah, I'd like to do this. How about we just do a couple weeks to make sure it's the right fit? And she said, sure, that's great. So I started working there. I was still taping Jacques Pepin's show. And, some guys offered me a job to open up this other restaurant, and I think it was called MC Squared, and I was looking to move up. I was actually looking to get a sous chef title at that point
sure,
in time
yeah,
for my career,
course.
And so they had offered me that position. So I went back to Trace. I said, you know, I don't think I'm going to stay. I said, I've got this sous chef position, and I think I want to do this. It's a new restaurant, and she's like, well, she goes, yeah, you're not going to do that. She goes, you're going to stay here. I'm like, what? And she goes, you're going to stay here. She goes, you know, her chef at the time or running the kitchen was Richard Reddington. And she said, Richard, he'll be here for a year. That was our commitment. He's going to leave. She goes, you can move up at that point in time. She goes, and you're not going to go to this other place. She goes, I don't even know these people. She goes, you need to be here. I'm like, well, let me think about it. And so I went home. I thought about it. I came back and I was like, I think I'm going to go take the other job. And she's like, no, you're not. And I'm like, okay. I said, if Tracy Desjardins is telling me I'm not going to do it, I'm going to listen to her. So
she pulled the Jedi mind trick.
She
on
totally
you, right?
did. Yeah, she just did. And I also liked how she treated everyone there. You know, L'Espanasse was not necessarily the most pleasant kitchen to be in. You know, it was a great learning experience, but it was also, as much as I loved Chef Koons' food, the atmosphere in the kitchen was a brutal New York kitchen. You know, it was kind of at times meatheadish, and
yep.
Tracy did not have that at all. And I liked that, and I liked how people were treated, and there was a great family meal. And so I felt like this woman kind of – I could learn something from her besides just cooking. So I stayed with her, and lo and behold, Richard took off at his said time. I moved up, and, you know, Tracy was – she was so great for me because she has so little ego. She was able to kind of groom me to kind of run the kitchen, and also she didn't have a problem giving me some of the spotlight. So – she would tell press that I was the chef there, that I was doing things, and she had no problem whatsoever. All the while, she was kind of watching my back to make sure I didn't screw up too much, you know. And so it was a great. She's probably the most. We don't necessarily have the same cooking styles, but she taught me a lot about produce and how to appreciate it. But she definitely probably has the most impact on me as a chef in my life, just because of how she ran her business, treated her people, and ran her businesses, and put out really amazing product at the same time.
Sounds like she gave you some amazing advice, too.
And, yeah, stay.
It's a good
leave.
Thing that you stayed. I mean, who knows what would have happened if you would have gone to MC Squared or whatever. But
I think they closed 6 months later.
I think you made the right – well, they might not have if you were there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But I think you made the right choice.
Yeah, I would have saved them.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. In our industrial world, most wines have become brands, but the wines I love are so much more. Fine wine is a civilizing substance that connects us to nature. It cannot be stamped out in a factory. If you're listening to this great show, you probably eat different. I urge you to drink different too. Go deeper. Cane5.com.
Welcome back to Chef Story. I'm here with Douglas Keene. And Douglas, talk to me a little bit about Shibumi.
Shibumi, yeah. I spent so much time in Japan, and the first time I was there, I just realized how everything they try to achieve perfection at every level that they do things, and they also, you go to a sushi restaurant there and it's just sushi. It's not like where you go to a sushi restaurant here where there's everything. It's they perfect a craft, and so I would just kind of study the culture and the people, and I came upon this word one time, and it was shibumi. It was refined simplicity, simple elegance, unobtrusive beauty, and quiet perfection.
That's a long definition for a short word.
Yeah, it is. It's more of a philosophy or a path, you know. And so I used to love the adrenaline, like in a kitchen like L'Espanasse or Four Seasons or Jardiniere. It was like there was all this testosterone to move and to push and energy. And I went over to Japan and I realized that the food was just as good, if not better. And these kitchens were silent. And people, there was mise en place done, like most things were done perfectly ahead of time. And then the things that were finished were like a sauce was finished or the fish was seared or garnishes were cut. And it was just, there was this peace. And I really liked that. And so I tried to bring that back to Cyrus after the first time and went from this really busy, busy kitchen to kind of like slowing it down just a little bit and thinking more about having mise en place, having everything in place, but also thinking through that, how can you like make it perfect and refine it? And so that's really what I've tried to do. And I don't by any means claim that I'm there with shibumi, but it's kind of what I try to do with everything.
Is it a word that's often used in the context of culinary there?
I don't think at all.
No. So no. It's more of a lifestyle.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So you've adopted it to the way you cook and
the way I try to cook.
And the way
yeah.
you think about, does it influence the way you think about menu items?
Menu items, design, everything. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And the organization of the kitchen for sure. And how I manage. Because you it's, I have to remember now it's been a few years which I've kind of changed my approach and you have to realize people coming into you to work under you, this is new to them. So you kind of have to take them through and say, no, we don't have to do it this way. You don't have to slam the door. You know, you take them through slowly about how you can be kind of methodical. It doesn't have to be. Sometimes people don't think. And there's people at Cyrus towards the end that didn't think it was a hard kitchen. I was like, great. I was like, I'm actually okay with that. I said, look at our food. You know, do you see the end product? You know, you don't have to be stressed to put out good product.
Right. So the kitchen is a peaceful environment?
I hope at times. I mean, that's what we strive
it's
for.
Still a kitchen after all, right?
It's still a kitchen, and at times you need to pull everyone into focus, you know. But yeah, it shouldn't have to be rah 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 all the time.
So I understand that you had a fellowship at the Japanese Culinary Academy, which I also understand only 4 chefs from around the world do that. Is that each year?
Yeah, they would grab 4 people each year and bring them over, and usually they focused on like an area. Like one time they did America, and I think it was Kinch and Chang and couple other people went, and then the next year they were doing I think South America or Brazil maybe, and someone bowed out, and so they asked David Kinch who would like to go, and he said I know Doug would, so they called me and I went, and it was just incredible. I loved everything about Japan already, but these guys, they took us into Kyoto. There was about 10 to 15 chefs in that kind of ran the program, and I found out afterwards or during it that the reason I couldn't figure out why they would do this, so because they spent like 20 days with us or 15 days with us. We worked in their kitchens during the day. We went shopping during the afternoon, and then they took us out to dinner at night. And then we did tea ceremonies. But they were with us almost the whole time. You know, most of them, or for certain aspects of it. And I couldn't realize one how they afford to do this because it wasn't cheap. We were staying in a hotel the whole time, and they were taking us out to dinners. But why? What did they get out of it? You know, and they are so steeped in tradition there that they want to expose the younger chefs to people from around the world so that they kind of get fresh ideas as well. So it was really great for us to work with some of these younger guys too and talk with them about ideas. And I mean, I remember we had to like create a dish towards it. It was kind of, they didn't really ask that much of us, but we came up with a dish from our studies, and I like to use white soy sauce. And I remember asking one of the older guys, one of the older chefs, says, can I get white soy? And no. I'm like, okay. No. And a couple minutes later, talking to one of the younger chefs, and I said, yeah, I wanted to use white soy with this because I like it to be kind of clear, like lighter, but I guess you guys don't use it. And he says, we use it. He goes, the old guys don't use it. They don't like it, but we use it. So there's a lot of that. Like it's a traditional culture, but it's just amazing. And it was one of the coolest things I've been able to do.
Yeah, it's great to be able to learn from the old timers who do everything
perfect,
the traditionally perfect way, and then see some new interpretations of that and be able to do that yourself. I think that's great.
It was really eye opening. It was I was one of the luckier things I've ever been able to do.
I mean, incidentally, you've mentioned Andre Saltner and Jacques Pepin, two of our deans who are, you know, classic and rooted in the classics and doing everything just so and have done it just so for so long. You also mentioned David Kinch, who's one of our newer deans, who I think is you know, like you, really learned about that tradition and then taking it in a different direction.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, watching someone like Jacques Pepin work is just beautiful. I mean, it was so effortless to see him do anything. You know, you can throw a pan in that guy's hand at any point in time of the day, and there's no stress, there's no anything. And so it to be that comfortable, I think, you know, talking about 1,000 roast chickens, it's that I think is what it takes to get that good, you know.
Maybe Jacques' performance in the kitchen is kind of a shibumi in itself, right? Kind of
absolutely
peaceful. And
yeah, watch him bone a quail.
He's a mechanic.
Oh, he's an artist with it. It's just impressive. Yeah.
So Japan has really influenced your cooking?
Yeah, the flavors, you know. I was trained kind of French. I guess most of us were trained French because that was really all that there was at one point. And I think when you're younger, you also cook. Fat is really great, like more the better when you're younger, because one, you can actually digest it. It's like it doesn't hurt you. But two, there's just that, oh my God, that's a butter sauce. That's incredible. That creme brulee, oh my God, I've never had anything like this. But I think as I've grown and I've realized that I don't like people leaving the dining room stuffed. I like them to leave actually satiated, but like happy and comfortable. Like there's no uncomfortable. They're not full at all. Not full. They're full, but they're not over full, I should say.
Right. They're not hungry.
Yeah.
They're happy with what they had, but they don't feel over full. I wish there was more of that, because I mean, part of the problem is that my wife never finishes anything, and so I finish it. But I do, even
it's
if I'm only
truffle season.
Yeah, exactly. Even if I'm only eating my own, and I eat quite a lot, I feel like I'm often leaving a tasting menu feeling overly full.
Yeah, and I used to do that at Cyrus. I would, and people would not complain about it, but you would hear, "Oh, wow, I'm really stuffed," and I thought that for a while was a good thing. And then so I started to look at I started to eat the omakase meals in Japan at the in Kyoto especially. And I would leave after like 20 courses, and I would feel amazing. I mean, I think the origin of the word restaurant is to restore people. You know, I think that's where it came from. Okay. People could stop and restore themselves. But many times you don't feel that way when you leave. In Japan, I felt that way. And so I started to study what they do, and I realized that carbohydrates are placed very strategically in the meal. And they don't cook. There's very few carbs throughout the meal. So instead of starting a meal with a big – we had a bread basket with like 10 breads at Cyrus, and they were all miniature and they were all perfect. And they would be baked twice a night, so they'd come out crunchy, hot, and perfect. It was hard not to eat four of those things. But by then, you're stuffed. And then you get into, you know, some other foie gras terrine with some brioche to it, or you know, the pasta course or anything. Those carbs fill people up. And so to cook with less carbs and to satiate through umami versus fat is really where I went with my food. And I think where I kind of broke from tradition with Japanese styles, I kind of use aggressive acid, because I think that also brings you back. It makes you want to have a little bit more. And also it perks you up for the next course as well, I think. Like, wow, I want more of that, but it's gone. And Japan, they're a little less aggressive with the acid than I am.
Okay. So does that mean that you're cooking in a similar type of style, but with more Western ingredients and techniques?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's one of the things that's kind of cool about cooking in the States is there aren't really many rules, you know, whereas if you go to Japan, and I think if I did my food in Japan, I think they'd be like, who is this guy? Like, this isn't Japanese food, you know, like, even though over here people say, oh, he cooks very Japanese. It's, you know, I've had Japanese chefs say, wow, it's not Japanese, it's interesting. But yes, because I don't have to follow any rules, you know, and I really let the ingredient kind of take me, and then take the umami versus acid to try to bring it all into balance.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about Two Birds, One Stone.
Yeah, our newest baby.
Yeah, well, congratulations, you know, welcome to the scene, right?
Thank you. Yeah, I had a few years off, so I guess it's time to work nights again. It It's great. It's Two Birds, One Stone is a California-inspired yakitori. So I partnered with Chef Sang Yoon from Father's Office in Lukshan. We became really good friends while taping Top Chef Masters. We kind of competed against each other, but also kind of, you know, fell in respect for each other. Just his food was tight. We thought a lot about food, a lot about acid, a lot about how we like to do things. And we started talking, so at some point it might be fun to do something. So this opportunity, Barbara Banky from Jackson Family said, we have this spot over in St. Helena. We're going to do a huge renovation to it. Do you have any interest in it? And I looked at the building, and it was kind of beat up, but it was gorgeous. It was this old Napa Fieldstone. I think it's from 1886. It's one of the most beautiful buildings around. You could see the bones of it. And so I was like, wow, this would be a pretty cool place to do something in, as long as I can do something unique. And I told her that Sang and I wanted to do something Japanese-inspired, but California-rooted. And yakitori is obviously just grilled chicken, but we said we're going to kind of blow that out a little bit, and just we're gonna stay traditional to the live fire aspect and kind of do the Binchotan charcoals, but we want to put our spin on it. So instead of just getting a skewer of chicken thigh with like a little salt and a squeeze of lime, we're going to take the chicken thigh, we're going to brine it, we're going to cook it perfectly, maybe even sous vide it, and then finish it on the charcoal. We're going to take the skin out and add a component of texture to it by crumbling it and making like a chicken skin ebi almost, where there's seasonings and cracklings in it. And then we're going to add a sauce and some vegetables. So it's almost like a composed dish. It's taken a little bit further. So again, rooted in tradition, but kind of blown all the shreds. And so we just opened about a week ago.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's great, too. We're having a lot of fun with it. It's fun to collaborate. It really is, man. It's at a certain level, you're always teaching, or it's always on your shoulders. It's really fun to kind of work with someone and learn from them as well, because he has a whole different style as well that, you know, he's a very creative guy. And I think I balance him in the fact that I'm like, all right, let's make sure this is right before we put it on the menu, where he's very excited just to do things. And 9 times out of 10, they're awesome right from the beginning. But I'm like, all right, let's make sure we can do this. Let's make sure the prep guys can handle this. You know, I'm much more practical than that.
Right. So it's yakitori primarily.
Yep.
Do you have other things to round out the menu, or are you really sticking to this true item as the main focus?
We have a lot of other things on the item. It's basically a poultry-driven restaurant.
Yep.
So I would say 75% of the dishes are poultry-based, and there's amazing chickens and ducks and quail and duck eggs up there. And so there's a lot of great poultry in Northern California. So we said, let's be the main focus. But then we also fell in love with there's a farmer, Tucker Taylor, who Jackson Family hired him a few years ago. He was the gardener at French Laundry, and then they brought him over to do their gardens. And this guy's produce is pure art. He's on Instagram, and you can look at his stuff. It's just gorgeous to look at. But when you taste it, you taste a radish like you've never tasted a radish before, or a baby carrot. And it's, you know, Sang and I did an event there. We did a tomato festival, and it was like a mini competition, and his produce was what we were getting to use mostly. And Sang's like, you mean we would get to use this stuff if we open this restaurant? Yeah, we can have them grow almost exclusively for us. And
wow.
So it was really a big inspiration. So you'll see a ton of vegetables on the menu, which also fits in the California, you know, so it's not as traditional as typical yakitori.
I'm certainly envious of where you live. The produce
is
amazing. I don't get out there that much, but when I do, I take note, because it really is spectacular.
It's an amazing place to cook. I mean, you know, Manhattan's a special place because of the energy and the people. But when you get out west, and the fish here is pretty amazing in New York as well. But when you get out west, there's just nothing like the produce. When I first moved out there, when I was working for Tracy, we were writing a special together one day, and she said, let's do black-eyed peas. I'm like, oh, cool. That sounds great. And so you know where this is going. I ran upstairs to the storeroom. I'm hanging out, looking. I run down like 15 minutes later. I'm like, Chef, there's no black-eyed peas. She's like, no, they're in the walk-in. They're fresh.
You're looking for them in dry stores.
I swear to God, I didn't even – the concept of the fact that they were fresh at some point hadn't even hit my mind. And I'm like, oh my God, there's a season for everything.
Yeah.
Even dried peas have a season at first. And so it was kind of eye-opening, actually. But yeah, I think California is pretty amazing for that.
And for our listeners who have not had the pleasure of eating fresh beans that are typically dried and on your supermarket shelf, it's night and day.
It's incredible.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Fresh lima beans, not out of a freezer bag.
And, exactly.
And fresh cocoa beans I had in France. They're a white bean. I'm not even sure what we would call them here.
Yeah, I think they call them cocoa beans
still
here, yeah.
Still one of the best things I've ever eaten.
Yeah.
We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Chef Story. I'm here with Douglas Keene, and we're talking about Two Birds, One Stone, which just opened in St. Helena, California.
Yep, you got it.
I'm impressed. You must be a great manager to be able to be here less than a week after your new restaurant has opened.
I don't know if I'm a great manager, but I've got a great team.
All right.
Got a lot of good support.
Good. So tell me a little bit about Cyrus. Cyrus, as most of us know, is a 2-Michelin-star restaurant for many years in a row.
Yep.
Certainly one of my favorite alumni by the name of Andrew Burnham used to work for you at Cyrus.
Andrew did, yeah. I just got a text from him yesterday.
Yeah, he's working with David Kinch and Manresa now.
Yeah, he is. He's doing great.
So tell me about Cyrus. I know that you're in an iteration phase for the next round of Cyrus.
Yeah. So, you know, Cyrus was my baby. It was my dream of all dreams to open that restaurant. And we did, and we did a great job at it. We had an amazing team, and we had a great 8-year run. And then it came time that we had an issue with the landlord, and it was time. Sometimes divorce is better. You know, sometimes divorce is actually a good thing. And we realized that he wanted different things from a food restaurant there, and we didn't want to do certain things for a hotel, and we just said goodbye. And it was great. It was liberating, actually.
Okay. Must have been a tough decision, though.
It wasn't. You know, when you get in a situation like that, it's overbearing. It wasn't a pleasant situation, and so it's almost night and day that you're thinking about and dealing with it. And so to have it over is just one door closes, so many more doors open, and in so many ways, it was one of the best things I've done. And it was also, we went out on such a high. I mean,
sure.
There wasn't anything we couldn't achieve there. And the only thing I really regret was at the end of Cyrus, I had a kitchen team that was probably my favorite because of the way they worked together. And I don't even know if they were the best cooks that I'd had there. They probably weren't. But the sum is greater than the parts. And these guys worked together and supported each other. And, you know, if one station went down, everyone was over to help. I missed that team. But besides that, it was the perfect time to close.
Okay. So you've been operating Healdsburg Bar and Grill, which is very successful.
Yep.
You've just opened Two Birds, One Stone, but you also have plans for a next version of Cyrus.
Yeah. We took over the bar and grill about 6 years ago, and it's like the best location in wine country. It's right on the square, and we have a great team there. It's a burger joint, and it is what it is, and everyone loves it for that. It's not going to change, and it fits a great purpose, and we have a team there that really takes care of it for us. But Cyrus, we have grand plans for Cyrus. We think we've got everything nailed down. We have found the perfect piece of land. We've been looking for. We want to create a real wine country restaurant. We want to create something that is literally in the vines, kind of like you see in Europe and in Australia and in other wine countries. In California, it's really hard because of zoning. They don't like to take ag zoning and put commercial things into it unless it's completely ag-related. There's a very strong argument to make that restaurants are ag-related, but wineries, it's more directly related to the crop.
Okay. And Two Birds, One Stone is in a winery, correct?
It is in a winery. It's in the Fremark Abbey Winery in St. Helena in Napa Valley. It's on the highway, on Highway 29, so it's actually commercially zoned. There is a vineyard behind it, but Napa has that tight corridor, so there's actually a lot of right on the highway, but we're not actually in the vines. So what our vision was is to literally create a restaurant that was floating above the vines. And so we were searching for a while, and I think we found the perfect spot. We found about 13 acres of land, and instead of taking ag land, turning it commercial, we're going to take commercial land and add some ag back to it. So we're going to plant 10 acres of grapes.
Even better, right?
Yeah, and we're going to create a building that we're actually creating a journey. It's more of a journey than it is a restaurant. So you're going to enter through the grapes, and then you're going to go into the first room, which we're going to call Bubbles. And it's almost like you go into someone's home, and you have champagne and small bites to start the dinner party. And there's going to be 12 people at a time, 12 guests at a time, not necessarily all to, like one party, but 12 people. And they'll stay in the Bubbles room, which will overlook the entire valley. And it'll be a glassed-in room and, you know, 25-foot ceilings and looking out, soaring above the grapes. And you'll have the canapes. We used to do sweet, sour, salt, bitter umami canapes at the Start Cyrus. So we're going to do that again and then kind of do stuff that pairs well with Bubbles. And then we're going to move you into the second part of the journey, which is going to be a chef's table. And it's going to be a rammed earth cylinder that kind of opens to the sky. And in that is going to be two chefs that will actually kind of commune with you. You'll sit basically at, for lack of a better description, like a sushi table. And we're going to do a raw version of raw fish and shellfish and vegetables. Not 100% raw, but very focused on raw, of just literally pulling things out of tanks in the back or pulling things out of the gardens that we have and prepared right in front of you for about four or five courses or six courses.
Wow.
And so you have some interaction as well. And then after that, you're going to the dining room to kind of and that dining room is going to be a series of tables that are all cantilevered off of the vine, so 10 feet above the vine, so you're literally floating in glass, and everyone will have a table on the window so that everyone, there's not a bad table in the house. And so you'll go into that part of the dinner and do kind of the more traditional, not traditional, but more of a plated courses and kind of finish the meal. I would almost call it the red wine portion of the meal.
Okay.
And at the same time, 12 more people will start. So we'll do 12 people at 6, 12 people at 7, 12 people at 8. So 36 people. And at some point, there's a full dining room. Not crazy busy, but you get a little bit of energy because you've been traveling with 12 people. But then you break off into your own party. And then after dessert served, we're going to there's also all these gorgeous terrariums throughout the building, these two-story terrariums of landscaped inside. So it's almost like an indoor-outdoor experience, like 20 feet terrariums where you, so it's soft. It's very soft when you're in there, even though there's a lot of glass and stone. After dinner, you're going to go into a dessert room. And I did this because I saw how much fun people had with the candy cart at Cyrus, what we would wheel out at the end. And it was a very traditional kind of mignardie cart. And then we would also drop little mini donuts on the table with a check. And I just watched people's eyes kind of get excited for all that stuff. So as you're taking this journey, I wanted to bring you back to the start of the journey with the sweet, sour, salt, bitter umami. And instead of having like 30 different candies that we did, I'm going to do 5 chocolates. And they're going to appear out of walls of flowing chocolate. So the entire room, you're going to walk into the room, almost like you walked into Willy Wonka's room where the wall kind of disappeared. And on your left and your right is going to be flowing walls of chocolate. And the smell is just kind of intoxicate you. And then slowly the water, the chocolate will stop flowing. And the boxes will come out, and you'll see a sweet canapé chocolate at the end, and then sour, salty, bitter umami kind of will take you through. And then you'll be able to kind of sit in that room for a little while, kind of take it in. We'll offer you like an adult hot chocolate coming out of a, you know, separate fountain, and then sneak out into the garden before you leave.
Wow. I guess you've thought about it a little bit.
Oh, yeah. We've had a couple of years to kind of work on this. We have an amazing architect we're working with, too.
So please refresh my memory of the definition of shibumi.
Refined simplicity, simple elegance, unobtrusive beauty, and quiet perfection.
I think that's what you just described.
Trying to, that's all in mind when we design it and when we do the menu, and it's all it's exactly what we're trying to do.
And when can we expect this to open?
That's a great question. It'll be a 18-month build, so we could technically break ground at any point. We just gotta kind of sign some things and finalize everything. So it's like, there's emails happening as we're talking, hopefully finalizing it.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with that.
Thank you.
And I do think radio hosts should absolutely make their way onto the friends and family.
Absolutely. You got
list.
It. You're invited.
Sounds fantastic. So we haven't talked about Top Chef Masters.
No.
I mean, this is a big deal. This is, you know, it's not just Top Chef, which is a big deal. It's Top Chef Masters, and you weren't just on it. You won.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me about that. That's a pretty amazing experience.
You know, it was an amazing experience. I don't know. I mean, I don't consider it the most important thing I've done, but it was fun, and I met Sang doing that. It was pretty challenging because the first part of it, I thought I was ready for it, and then the brilliance of these shows, I think, is that they take the control. They take control freaks, chefs, and people who are always in charge. And if you're a great chef, you everything is planned out very well. So they take you and they take complete power away from you and they don't tell you anything that's happening. So it creates kind of this recipe for some drama, which is obviously what they're looking for. But I wasn't quite ready for that, and I also wasn't ready to like be judged by people from Days of Our Lives, you know, that didn't know anything about food. And so I had a really hard time the first like 7 days where I almost left because, one, I couldn't check my ego. I was just like, what am I doing here? And then I remember talking to my wife. I called her. I'm like, I'm leaving tomorrow. I'm so done with this. Some idiot had talked about my curry, some radio guy from L.A. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like,
hopefully he's not listening.
His name is Jason. Sang knows him, actually. I ripped him pretty hard, actually. The dish was genius. Even the chefs were like, oh, my God. And this guy's like, that's not a curry. I'm like, well, that wasn't the competition. We're supposed to reinvent curry. But I had to get over myself right then and there. And so my wife's like, just stay another day. You're doing this for the dogs. She's like, shut up and deal with it. And so I kind of just gut checked myself that night. And I'm like, all right, you know what? You're right. Who cares? Let's have fun for this. Let's win some money for the dogs. And it's not about you. You're just having fun. And so I went back and I just relaxed and I started having fun with it. And I mean, I won at the end, but you know, it wasn't really.
So what kind of, how's the pressure in that different than the pressure of running a 2-star Michelin restaurant?
The pressure is what you make it there, because the time limits are real. You know, you're cooking for a half hour, knives up, or whatever they say. That's actually real. But it's people aren't paying for the meal. You know, I feel a really strong obligation to people that pay $200 or more for a meal. I feel like you owe them something pretty impressive and pretty perfect. There, it's just, you know, it's like, can you put together a burger in 15 minutes or you can't?
Right.
You can or you can't. It's like, all right, as long as you kind of gut check yourself and you're not embarrassed to put up a bad product, because who does that? No one really does those types of things. So if you get lucky and pull it off, then you get lucky. So there was pressure towards the end just because I was so close to the money for the charity that I was like, I really do want to win this. It would make a huge difference. We were a brand new charity. We had like 4 volunteers at the time and no operating budget. And it was such a cause that I believed in that I wanted to. So when I was able to do that, it was, you know, there was a little pressure at the end, but it was great.
And did you have to prepare specifically for the competition?
Not at all. I had no idea. I'd never even watched the show.
Right. You just walk in, you know how to cook, you've been doing it for years, so you're going to you're gonna wing it. And
I thought I'd be gone within a week or two.
Okay.
I really did. I had no intention of winning, because I really don't cook like that. Like, that's why Sang probably did so well at it, because he can cook off the cuff. Like, he just thinks and goes, and I am so much more planned out. And so I was like, well, this is going to be a struggle, but whatever, I have the time now. You know, you needed like 3 weeks to commit to it. I'd never had that time before Cyrus closed, so now I did. I'm like, all right, you know, I'll do it.
You have to be very organized in the moment, but you can't be organized ahead of time, right?
Exactly. And I think that was one of my strengths, is every time they would give us a challenge, everyone would run to go grab whatever they're supposed to grab, and I would just park myself at my station, set up my knife, set up my spoons, my water, and I'd think about it. And then I'd walk back to see what was left. I was like, oh, okay, I'm cooking eggs. That's the only thing that's left. And it was like, okay, great. You know, so it was this piece about it that I got.
So you weren't the one running to go grab the ingredients.
I can't run anymore. I've got a bum leg, so it was perfect. Yeah.
So you talked about winning money for a charity. This is the Green Dog Rescue Project.
Yeah.
I'm a dog lover. I'm fascinated by this. I did a little bit of reading about it. And first of all, congratulations. I think it's an awesome thing to do.
Thank you.
And I applaud you for it. Tell me more about it.
Yeah, it's one of the better things I've done in my life. It is based – so I was working – I decided – we have a 5-acre plot of land, and my wife and I do, in Alexander Valley. And we said we're going to have a dog rescue at some point. And so I was thinking, and I'm like, I should probably learn more about dogs. I love them, but like how they behave and things. So I decided to get certified as a dog trainer. So I took these night classes and did it. And part of that was to go work at shelters. So I was volunteering at the local shelter, and it was amazing how frustrating it was to watch these dogs that we were working with get put down after you'd make some progress with them, and it just drove me crazy, but I couldn't figure it out. And then I started hearing about this woman at this business called King's Castle, which was just down the street, you know, in the next town, and about 100 dogs running around in a pack, and she's doing rehab and boarding, and she helps shelters. So I went down to take a look, and I had actually asked her help with one of the dogs that they were getting ready to put down. And I'd fallen in love with this guy, Jake, and I couldn't let him go. I was trying to do anything to save him. And she's like, I'll take them. You know, I'll take them for a weekend. You know, see, I'll tell you what I think. She goes, I'm not promising anything. And what happens is so the shelters were built to protect humans from animals. That's the reason that they were, and to cage them. But as we learn more about animals, they're actually pack creatures, and they're social, so they need to be around. So you take a dog, a stray dog or a bad dog or a hurt dog, and you throw it into a prison, basically, put it in isolation, it's going to deteriorate.
Right.
And there's it's not bad that we had this system. We had to do it. But now that we learned so much more about it, you walk into a pack of animals that's being run right with one alpha person or two alpha people managing it. There's a sense of peace, and these dogs want to belong to the pack, and they just tend to behave. So 99% of the dogs that we would bring down there with issues would literally walk into the pack, kind of cowering because they didn't know what to do, and then within like an hour or two, they were in there playing, and all of their problems were fixed. And the dogs really don't get sick that much, unlike they do in the kennel. And it just makes so much sense when you see it and when you study it that I truly believed in it. So I talked to Colleen. She actually spoke with me. She said, I've always wanted to start a nonprofit. And I do a lot of pro bono stuff because I'd love to be able to raise money for it and do it the right way. And I said, all right, I'm in. And I was just sick of seeing dogs. You know, they have these no-kill shelters, which is a great concept because it's an improvement. But no-kill is kind of a misnomer because it means that you euthanize less than 10% of the animals.
Okay.
So you drop a dog off at a no-kill shelter. If their time's up, their time's up. You know, or if they have any sort of behavioral problems, they're not going to get a second chance. This... we throw it in the pack, and it's a more efficient, more economical, and it's more humane because these dogs get to socialize. And so to date, so the TV show, you know, we had like 4 volunteers. We had about 10 dogs that we were just trying to work with. And then the TV show happened. We won, I think I won 120 grand for them, but I think they have over 100 volunteers now. They've saved 500 dogs all off of euthanasia lists. They go into other shelters and grab them. And it's just a great model, and I truly believe in it. And now I'm more of a, you know, I don't really get to play with the dogs as much because I'm busier, but I raise money for it. I try to get down there. There's a couple dogs I'm still attached to. Jada and Jakey are still there, so I go and see them. But
that's fantastic. That's really awesome.
Yeah, thanks.
So we picked up Lucy 14 and a half years ago from the North Country Animal League in Morrisville, Vermont. She had been picked up as a stray recently, and they thought she was somewhere between 2 and 4 years old, so you can do the math.
Yeah.
She's a big dog. She was about 75 pounds at her full weight. She hasn't been able to hear in years, but I'll see if I can explain your project to her. I think she'll appreciate it.
At this point, she probably doesn't want to go into a pack.
Yeah, no.
She shouldn't have to.
Yeah, she's the leader of the pack in our
household.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's for sure. But that's really rewarding. I think that, you know, chefs are always so busy that you don't have time often to give back and do as much as you'd like to. So you're making time, and I really appreciate that. I think it's fantastic.
Thanks. I think like this celebrity chef thing is kind of interesting to me. It's dinner, and it's kind of taken on a life of its own. So I kind of laugh at it from afar. But if I can use it to leverage for stuff like that, then I'm willing to exploit it a little bit. And so I've been able to do that with the Green Dog Rescue Project.
Yeah, absolutely. Leverage celebrity to have a voice that people are listening to, right?
Yeah, and for people that are animals that don't have a voice.
That's great. And finally, I want to talk about your app. You're teaching people to cook through the iTunes store, the App Store.
Yeah, thanks. Keen on Ingredients. I came up with it. It's almost like a business card where it's like, just get to know me. But I wanted people to look at it and say, I feel like based off of ingredients, you know, so I feel like cooking scallops today. What can I do? So we have a couple recipes on there for that. I added dashi because I wanted to show seaweed and so to give a basis for kind of the food that I like to do. But there's also simple pickling recipes. And it's basically all based off of like 8 ingredients. And you can look and say, all right, corn's in season today or this week or this month. You can go and say, all right, there's 2 or 3 recipes with corn. What can I do with it? And actually some great photography that goes step by step by step to show you what it should look like as well. It's a lot of fun to do it.
And you have a test kitchen, so you're kind of developing the app through that?
Yeah. We have a test kitchen in Healdsburg, still getting ready, doing R&D for Cyrus. We did a lot of R&D for 2 Birds, 1 Stone as well. But I have a chef that's worked with me, Drew Glassell, for about 15 years now. So he and I do the test kitchen, and we come up with stuff, and as we see fit, we add it to the app, or it's just for research, really.
Yeah, it sounds fun. I mean, you got a lot going on.
I do, yeah. Well,
it's really good to meet you, and you know, thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And
Dorothy will be back next week. I want to thank the Chef's Story team as well, but wish you the best of luck on Two Birds, One Stone. And
thank you.
Can't wait to hear more about Cyrus opening in the next 18 to 36 months, shall
exactly.
we say?
Exactly, yeah. We might have some news in the next couple weeks.
All right, we'll keep looking out for it. So thank you all for listening, and that's it for Chef's Story today. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Thank you.